I do want to remind you that there won't be an intermission, so you should feel free to get out and use the restroom or order a drink, but please try and keep the volume down out of respect for our leaders.
And of course, we do want you to silence and turn off all cell phones. Now to introduce our first leader, here is Colleen Mayo.
The microphones. Perfect. Now? Okay. I brainstormed several different approaches to this introduction. Rita and I have known one another for a lifetime in Tallahassee terms, from sitting by side by side throughout boot camp to lit courses, workshops, conferences, hell, weddings, epic themed parties, multiple cross-state explorations to honky-tonks, drag shows and Beyonce concert. I mean, over 3 years, there's some pressure, and I didn't really know how to start. So first, I planned on beginning with our certain witchy connection. Not just cats and moons, but how we both look for spirits in the corner of every room. We both worship rich food made from broth and bone and spice. We both love brazen luxury, gold and velvet, and we love breasts and butts and sex, and how both of us look not to fill that up our own witchy lives with all those things, but that we like to summon them in our writing too. And I think we both felt this connection from the very beginning. And then maybe I thought I'd connect all of that to spells and how Rita herself can work like a spell sometimes. That her frequent invocations of food and booze and sex can work as rebellion, that she binds word with power in her poetry, and that her presence has gravitational effects on a room. I know you've all felt it. When Rita speaks, heads turn. You find yourself stepping closer to her. And even if you don't always want to hear what she's saying, you listen. You feel her words threading into your thoughts long after you've shared a room. And she often changes you, turns your perspective sideways, then sideways again, then punctures hole after hole until you're seeing something from a different angle, in a new light, and you think, damn, that witchy bitch was right all along. My relationship with Rita, as her friend and also as a reader of her critical and creative work, has been full of these moments, and I know you will experience that tonight as well. But I scratched that. I thought, no, don't do the witchy thing. They already know that. Hell, they've all met her. The woman has claws for nails and owns more black clothing with moons on it than you can buy this month at a Halloween store. Although tonight, side note, she wore, I think, what might be the most colorful article of clothing in her closet, which I'm gonna just chalk up to like an intuitively rebellious spirit. So, I decided I would disclose something to y'all. I thought I'll give them a peek into our friendship. It's been a jagged yet strong line, as our relationship has been shaped by as much challenge as it has comfort. We have our differences, after all. Pisces and Virgo, we're an unlikely pair. I often shield myself with Southern manners and false humility, and I'm still rinsing out all the deep conditioning to apologize for other people's discomfort. Rita prefers scalding honesty and bravado, and she often thrives on, even cultivates, discomfort. These are attributes that I have been sometimes mystified by, but I am more often, more and more, extremely impressed and envious of. And then I thought I'd use all of that to segue into an essential dichotomy of Rita. Her tongue and wit are often razor sharp, and yet she possesses an incredible tenderness. I thought I'd shock the room by saying what Rita rarely chooses to divulge about herself. She's vulnerable. And the proof is in her poetry, which pulses between ferocity and sensitivity, that her writing is often the place where these two elements wrestle with one another the most. In her poem, Unholy, for example, Rita writes about women and wolves. Wolves, she says, might seem like strange company to keep, but if not wolves, then who? They are honest in their savagery, in their shaggy coats, which remind me that the body is just something full to slip away from. And then I thought, no. Anyone who really gets Rita already knows that that's not quite right, is it? I mean, all of what I said, her sharpness, her softness, the way Rita's work constantly reckons with both as she explores myth and memory and culture and identity, the way her writing and Rita herself always understands, usually before the rest of us, that transformation necessitates discomfort, all of that is true. Yet to characterize her as a dichotomy is a lame move, because she's not about binaries at all. In fact, Rita wants to take a diving sledgehammer to all of that. Her scholarship, her creative writing, shit, her fashion. She's about wrecking shit up, mixing it all together, comfort and challenge, fragility and swagger. I mean, all of the above, right? Simultaneous nourishment and confrontation. That's why her words and her presence spellbinds us. With Rita comes the nerve to probe everything, the smarts to turn anything and anyone sideways, and perhaps most importantly, the commitment to making visible the feelings, experiences, and identities that have most often been decreed dispensable. And with exploring all of that comes the real magic. Rita Mukherjee's creative work can be found in Iduna, New Delta Review, Glitter Mob, Refroid, and Cosmonauts Avenue. Her critical work has been featured in the Routledge Companion of Literature and Food, the Bloomsbury Handbook for Literary and Cultural Theory, and the Bloomsbury Handbook of 21st Century Feminist Theory.
Yes, Robin!
And applause necessary for this too. She is not a one, but a two-time winner of the Edward F. and Marie C. Kingsbury Graduate Fellowship. And her first poetry chapbook, Becoming the Bronze Idol, is forthcoming from Bone and Ink Press. And because she's a motherfucking witch, Rita likes her steaks extremely rare. Please join me in welcoming Rita Mukherjee to the stage.
To all of you for coming. Can we do it one time? Are you ready to get weird? Okay, I'm not convinced, but we'll see. So this Shopee, everybody. So this first poem is for Will Ferguson, and he's getting married next week to one of my best, rudest friends in the whole world, Molly. And Will and I workshop together a lot because we share absolutely none of the same poetic sensibilities. None of them. So this is a poem that Will really likes of mine, and it's called Origami Move Quantum. I cried
increase my paranoia into dying stars. People write their wishes on paper. I can't leave them that way. They'll just become lines on my face. And all of this folding, my purse down, swims to the front of my mind. It's rows of artillery, it's collapsing roofs, a gentle burning, all celestial horrors. I seal these memories away in each pentagram because the past only reminds me of the many places I can never revisit. How the roads broke when threatened with exits. How my body is a thing to be modified, the way monarch butterflies cover a deer carcass at the roadside. Scarlet wing points ablaze. Hold your applause, please. So much. It's going to get really exciting. Just hold on to it. These poems escalate in terms of weirdness, and we're going to hit like peak horniness in the middle. Let's hold on to it. Are there children? David yesterday in workshop said something about like, oh, make sure to tell the children to cover their ears. And it occurred to me that I've never in my brown life written a poem that was appropriate for children. So I'm scanning my new contacts and I'll see children. Let's proceed. Love it. This is called I Date God for a While. It's just okay. Because he likes it when I ask about his writing, though I read his book with its rocks and seeds and fires. I didn't find it very good. I tell him about the gemstones in an orange, about speaking subalterns, red tide, and the deep web. He praises me for my observation skills. Each night I try to remember the universe as he has shown it to me, but I'm distracted by white cheese and sweet wine. I tell him about my research. When I recount his wars, I ask if he regrets any. He smirks and says, would you? After a couple of drinks, he laughs about Mesopotamia and tells me where to find the third cradle of man, like I care. Cradled men never served me well. When I don't heed his convictions, he calls me sassy. Because mortality is his kink, and he gets off on becoming me, becoming naked, becoming bone, becoming sand, becoming fiber in the light. He explains how he takes me against his thumb and pressed me to a star. He gets annoyed when I ask about the muses, the fates. He claims there's more to life than loving dead girls. I break it off when I see him without his mask. When he thinks I'm sleeping, with his head to the side, I see that he is vapor. Sort of a milky smear. I see that it was posture, good lighting, all along. He doesn't kiss me goodbye. I think better of him. Okay, this next poem is called Kink, and this is the first poem, I'm really excited to tell you this. This is the first poem where I ever used the word girth. Girth is important. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. This is called King. You enter a hot trance in the bath, mulling over the occult, jotting notes in a makeshift grimoire to figure out 100 ways to make your nipples show through your shirt, dreaming up the right combination of sick and sweet, open thighs and clenched jaws, dreaming of a dark bookstore full of crystal quartz and rugs for nude lounging, full of dirty revelations, wearing dark-haired woman intuits what you need so that you can focus on glass and girth. You only keep these habits if, like the Sphinx, you hold all questions and answers so you well up with cleverness and hold your codex between your legs. Okay, now we're going to move into a piece about the teenage years. I am what one would categorize as a late bloomer. Do we have late bloomers in the room? That makes me feel so much better. So Eric Peterson is in the audience, and Eric's known me since I was about 7 years old. So you know that this is true, not false. There's a really unfortunate photograph of me on Colleen and Anthony's refrigerator if you ever go to their house in mustache tag. You can see what I look like as a teenager. I had a lot of issues to work through. Some of you know this. I was one of like three people of color in my school, not counting my siblings. So it's a weird time. This is called Blooming Late, Talking Dirty. At 15, I was two padded bras, layered, masquerading as breasts. Not blooming late, but a thistle knot, unyielding. At night, I'd steal away and call phone sex lines, hoping there was enough intimacy in this world for a thistle girl. There were those oozy voices, 1 minute, 30 seconds. I liked them. They were achy, bloody, sticky, felt like friends. They taught me to think about what to say for sex. Harder, deeper, squeeze me, drown it. I never talked back, but I think they could hear my thorny wishes. Give me something, touch me. So right now I'm in David's workshop, and this is a poem I just workshopped in there, and thank you to everyone who's in the workshop with me right now, especially the first years. What's up, if you're a first year poet? Who are you? Where are you? They're not here. You know what I don't have patience for is shy people. I just my breath. Right over here! I swear! I'll read to you Song of the Oyster Girl, Naked in the New World. This is a poem about Kitty West. She was a burlesque dancer, and, well, sure. And she's still alive, so I think she's pretty cool. And this workshop helped me a lot with this poem, so thank you for that, for all you silent people! When I change the thickness of my eyeliner or tug on my top to lengthen my cleavage, I remember Kitty West, who in 1945 came barrel housing out of two shells to delight everyone in the French Quarter. She lied in wait with her arms around a gigantic pearl and then emerged in a veil, making the birth of Venus look like a schoolgirl waiting for the bus. She cradled her perk against her cheek like it was the most precious thing in the world, and slide into a split with a gilded foot. She'd draw a figure eight, which is the sexiest number as long as you have a dirty mind. And you had to be dirty, I mean really dirty, to take your striptease out of the clubs and onto Bourbon Street, because anyone can strip well in the dark. There's no challenge in that. A true seductress is a topless daywalker, and you couldn't miss Kitty. Though there were a lot of girls giving the people what they needed in long gloves and sequin pasties. But Kitty took her sexy and mixed it with freaky and came up with waves of green hair to let the people know that she was a wayward sea goddess whose top fell off on her way out of the Atlantic. A savage mermaid outside of the Absinthe House, where patrons sipped juleps for $1.25 a head. Now I live the legacy of the Oyster Girl because these streets are teeming with sex. Tits and teeth are not enough to get what I want. I stay kinky and crazy and bold. And one day my hands will also fill with pearls. So keep your eyes on your wallet. I'm here to take your money and your man. So while we're talking about my sexuality, movies played a really big part in the formation of that, and so there's this movie that came out in 1968, which is where I show my age. So that movie is called the movie's called Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. That makes me really happy that some of y'all have seen it. So that was released, and there's this female protagonist. She's not queer per se, but she's queer to me. Her name is Truly Scrumptious. That knows. Like, that's her government name. Truly Scrumptious. That's pretty fucking gay if you ask me. So this poem is further, it's called Truly. How can you not be a lesbian when you watch movies with characters named Truly Scrumptious? I mean, she's on a beach in white frills like a three-layer cake, singing about her name, singing about the taste of her. But it's very chaste. I mean, I'll start over. You can learn a lot about my sexuality if you watch Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. I don't remember the whole story, but there's a faraway kingdom and a malfunctioning car and a pair of children. But I just want to see Truly Scrumptious, and she really is, because it's 1909 and she is out in the town, cruising in her weird car, a precursor to a bad bitch. Rumbles on her breasts. She almost runs over those extraneous children and ends up all wet in the pond. Takes the children to their single father. He is hustling her, trying to sell her all these little candy tubes, toot sweets, he calls them. But really all his sugar flute does is interrupt the movie. Every time Truly goes out, she ends up all wet in the pond. You're supposed to be happy when they're on the lam and hiding from an evil baron who wants Truly's stupid car. So everyone hides in a toy shop and acts like dolls, turn-of-the-century marionettes that abruptly perform a song and dance, which shows how in love they are. Which shows that children will have a mother, when really the most important things are Truly's dresses, wisps of cloud, and a big hat topped with pink roses and other just swirls of white lace. I wonder if Truly smelled like Lily of the Valley or exhaust from her car. If she would let me lie on her big dress and put my hand in her hat. Bullet bourbon, everybody. Okay. I saw Lana Del Rey at her bachelorette party. A lot of women in this room were here when we heard that. And I have a really love-hate relationship with the Lady Del Rey. So I tried to get out in front of that and write this poem. It's called Lana Del Rey Asks the Crowd for a Request. I don't feel sorry for attractive women with broken hearts. Buck up, buttercup, he never got you off anyway. I don't care how she pushes her tits together as she leans over the glass table to do her line. I don't want to hear about hard kisses, wild horses, or the wind on her face and the Cadillac under the sunset on the boulevard. Irresponsible driving isn't my idea of sexy, and I don't know anything about cars. So don't waste my time with a pinup girl song and dance, a blue collar mythos origin story of the wayward starlet. Red lipstick looks good on everyone. A rouge pal doesn't make you a knockout. It doesn't take sacrifice to look great in denim, to mourn a lost life with an imaginary lover, to walk on the beach and get people to look back at you, to be the only girl playing pool. To smoke cigarettes. Stop telling women to choose sadness over fury, as if this Americana bullshit ever had room for them in the first place. This is going to be my last poem, and thank you for joining me tonight. And this poem is dedicated to Zach, who is someone who's always accepted me, and someone who I think epitomizes the phrase, do no harm but take no shit. And I'm so honored to share the stage with you, Zach. Thank you so much. But to the point of this poem, I'm single. Hold your applause. And I'm nasty, so I'm on Tinder. And so every so often you match with some really awesome, interesting people, and then every so often you match with some awful people. So this poem about one of those awful people. Some of you might have seen my post on Facebook about this. Poem is called "A Man Threatens to Shoot Me on Behalf of Infidels for Trump." Infidels for for Trump reminds me of the Aryan Brotherhood, but I guess the latter is worse. The paradox should be obvious, but this is the problem with people who don't read books. Now, don't get on me about class issues and freedom of speech. You know what freedom looks like? The library. Where, unlike my house, everyone is welcome. You should have taken advantage of that. Because when you turn to talk shit to a brown chick in a bar, make sure you're not speaking her language. I mean, literally speaking her language. Because while you talk about Aryan, Arya is a Sanskrit word, which means exalted, which is the last thing that white people were if we look at technology, advancement, and dental hygiene. The real irony is that it was my people who came down from the Caucasus Mountains. The swastika is a symbol of my goddess, the one who wears a belt of severed male heads. My people invented numbers and bathing. The characters in your holy scripture look just like me, which I know isn't a problem for the infidel for Trump. And it's that classic redneck confidence which is beautiful. A complete alliance to the most flawed ideals, deep love for a flag that looks so much like the Union Jack that it borders on adorable. And so I fold my glasses and say to the meathead decked out in red, I don't know if you know this, but you lost. You lost and you continue to lose. You have the nerve to wrap those colors in Florida, a notorious traitor state where men hid in the salt plants, sunk into swamp mud, jumped to the Gulf, and tried to swim to Mexico rather than suffer Robert E. Lee's bullshit? Never mind the couple thousand that said, fuck it, and joined the Union troops. Don't get me started on Donnyboy. Because those jokes write themselves. Not like you, I'm no fucking cliche. So read a book, then come through and see me sometime, big boy. A black cat will laugh in the door when you drop your PF knot once I go to work on those infidel knees. Because you people always have the same two problems. No book learning and a total lack of imagination. Which is why you wouldn't expect my Louisville Slugger, the icon of a favorite pastime. And I don't mean baseball. I'm not America. I'm not Southern. I'm a brown girl and a violent bitch and a loud cunt. And my only hobbies are breaking necks and smashing kneecaps. So when you come through, be ready to give me that good head. And I don't mean give me that good pussy. You'll never be so blessed. What I mean is watch your neck because I've got plenty of room on my belt for you. Thank you.
Join me in welcoming the person who will introduce our second reader, Daniel Moisenko. Of speech, of dialogue, even, rather than the self-conscious, pendant, belabored prose. And isn't this what we hope for? What lyric poetry in part means for? Sprezzatura, to be made with close attention, but the sound like natural eruption, like dance. Zach delivers craft with seeming ease, and it is a pleasure. The
speaker of his poems guides the reader from observation to observation as if laying out a banquet table. Images and metaphors interweave. A pair of plastic scissors, riverbank tortoises, artisanal watermelons, dry erase ink, X-lax, cocaine, and on and on. The poem's voice supports this rush. It assures the reader and itself, but honestly. Sure, I could make the case for some honest goodness, one stanza concedes, but there is always one more way to mutate against the simple and the sweet. This is not to say simplicity and sweetness do not have a place in Zach's muscular, witty, often sexual poems. Nuanced transmutation of tone and a syntactical wriggling result in a complexity beyond dichotomies. And the speaker navigates his own meditations on domestic situations carefully, figuring that if easy is an accent chair from World Market moving in is keeping the chair's green velvet clean, it isn't work exactly, but a tricky change of habit. The chain of reasoning there and exact language pivot and balance beautifully at each line break, and though the speaker jokes, excuse me for all these excuses, my foot is good, my mouth is an idiot, we trust Zach's highly tuned lines that crackle with consonants and speed. We trust that the poems will ferry us across a variegated terrain of event, thought, and feeling for the unexpected and much needed. We, like the speaker of these poems, are thrust into the world's grime, its glitter, its fear, and hospitals and joy, melting into it, and knowing, as he writes, my body belongs to the weather. Zach Lindsay is a poetry student pursuing a PhD in creative writing at Florida State University and the assistant editor of the Southeast Review. His publications include poems and articles published or forthcoming in the Sonora Review, Nimrod International Journal, and African American Review, among others. Please join me in welcoming Zach Lindsay.
Stomping boots, and I hope that helps me. thank you, Laurel and Matt, for organizing and setting up and inviting us all to read. I wrote a poem last night that I'm going to start with. What? I don't think I said it, and I might not. Thank you, Daniel, for that introduction. What you might not know is that a week ago, I messaged Daniel again and said, actually, we need to scrap that last packet. Half of it is shit, and I need to rewrite it. And so half of what I'm going to be writing or reading tonight is new, so the paint is a little bit wet. The piece I'm reading first, I was inspired by, I think it's Ozell. Ozell, are you in the house by any chance? Yes, I think Ozell, when she starts her reading, reads something current. Is that right? Or did I make that up? Okay, perfect. She does. We're all going to pretend like she does because I set up my microphone. Thank you. So I'm reading this one. It's real fresh. It's called For Baron B. On the blacktop, along the track, against the gym's bricks, somewhere, you said, I teased you in middle school. Somewhere, relentlessly, you said, are you gay yet? You were seated in a circle, I'd run in, who used strange language, brown, white, blow, bars, bud, a C's. A sophomore. I'm not fucking gay, Zach. Dre gave you an out, keeping you in so many closets. Yeah, we did it. Okay. Then you were, and we were, in your parents' kitchen. I'd never seen so much plastic stacked in a fetid sink, and Camel filters stacked in the sink. Don't smoke inside, you said. I fucking hate it when she smokes inside. Your father, in his dent in the yellow cushioned couch, collecting unemployment, shook his head. Faggots. Through brown-edged teeth, he had a habit with watches, collected second hands, spun gears into and out of place. I blew my smoke out the window in your bare bedroom. You taught me to cut my own hair with a Bic razor by pressing my thumb against the blade at the nape of your neck. The less pressure, the more texture you get. Thank you for taking pictures with me on the playground. Costume earrings of knockoff Swarovski. A faded black turtle neck cut across the chest. My adolescent armpit hair exposed as I hung off the monkey bars. You smeared the lipstick across my face. I kept the eyeliner straight. Our hair was magnificent, Baron. Thick, dry, unruly curls. Thank you for offering me the needle, even if I didn't take it. I'm still the only person I know who, with heroin, can take it or can leave it. Mainly, you took it. In the backseat of my Blazer, making your fix, we kissed for the first and only time at the red light. I just want you to feel good. I didn't. Your name is written in thin, circular stains at the base of every spoon I eat from. You come back to me in stages. I don't know who you are. Even the playground only looks at you at night when nearby sirens bore and skinny dogs get kicked in the ribs. We can make it so you don't feel like the inside of a cheek ground into pavement, Baron. There are so many clean walls where I live now. I've got computers. You could use them. I have this phrase playing in my head for a long time and wanted to turn it into a title. I'm not sure the extent to which the poem relates to it, but the title for this poem is Don't Threaten Me With a Good Time. The rain in Peru some summer or other season, I'm not sure which, lacked whatever nutrients it usually had. So butterflies descended on the riverbank, tortoises, and drank their tears for the salt they needed to survive. You can't make this up. Mother Nature flapping unironic glitter wings, stealing what she needs of herself. I imagine the butterflies in clouds around turtle heads. My first thought is how cute. They're giving little kisses. Then I think deeper and up, pop artisanal watermelons and ears grown on the backs of mice. And I wonder if there isn't anything more trite, anything more embarrassing than how hard we try to improve nature's already on-the-nose profundities. Sometimes I see things for what they are. Garden parties, for example. Finding the right pair of curtains. The vanilla sex my lover and I have, often enough to make us both feel mutually wanted. Something like what you might call a kiss on a turtle's eye. These things I recognize as dreams formed right before, with, in me, even though I know I should have known better than to let them. Sure, I could make the case for honest goodness, but my perception, it's cheeky, it's a snowflake. Little is more try-hardy than my wanting something wonderful. I remain the man who picks up loose strands until each curtain unravels. I scrape the flaked paint, and I take the wall with it. I might wish I weren't the type to lie about checking the recycling for receipts. It's predictable, isn't it? Always one more way to mutate against the simple and the sweet. I'm writing my story with a bucket of straws, and every sip seems to keep me protected. I sink my fingers into anything I think I need, as if into a box of sand, as if claw marks were the prerequisite to having or to keeping. When I kiss my lover, I'd rather it were a kiss. When we dance across the carpet, our feet shouldn't be a ritual. Listening through my bedroom window, the rain changed. in our backyard chime with every drop, and the sound they make isn't any sort of music, but I will insist that it was. Weather the weather. Excuse me for all these excuses. My foot is good, but my mouth is an idiot. If you would believe me, believe only the parts I leather, or by leather for. My soles that sweat in the snow, my hands were the tips of my fingers, but only when yellow. If the weather is warm, know how I moved when you were not watching. No danger imposed itself upon the body, so I compensated. My legs burned in the lonely daylight, and I had to cool them. If you were watching, you would know how my hips were beside yours. Honest, warm, and waiting. If you weren't, don't believe me. My body belongs to the weather. The joints creak, which means they're nobody's, because nobody is watching. Watch me now. I am keeping my littlest parts in the freezer. I wrote a poem about dry erase markers. Okay. So this one's called Dry Erase. Dry Erase. We can't decorate the house together without stains, not without wood correcting crayons or spotted sheets and oily side tables. Blame the lube bottle's broken cap. My granddad's monogram glass jewelry tray reads BBB and seltzer water because lately I've assumed that all smooth surfaces are amenable to dry erase ink. The insides of my carelessly shaved thighs for 2 days bore traces of remember staple gun in cherry scent pink. Our bathroom mirror said phone, electricity, but I haven't yet marked everything. If easy is an accent chair from World Market, moving in together is keeping the chair's green velvet clean. It isn't work exactly to not write all over everything, but it is a tricky change of habit. So many cardboard boxes and twine, so much Sharpie. I almost left the floor unlabeled, but now the panels read donate beneath the last stack of books hastily boxed in my bachelor pad. I'm intent on leaving at least one polished plane unwritten out of courtesy, but if I don't remind my man that the serving tray has been polished, what then? Are we just going to let it shine? The next two poems are about masturbation. Teenage masturbation. Queer teenage masturbation. Because in the stories we tell, the one I don't hear enough of is queer teenage masturbation. Because there's something fucking beautiful about being a queer teenager coming into one's sexuality. And those fantasies, those first feelings, are a blush of romance that belongs to the fucking Louvre walls. So I'm writing two teenage masturbation poems, and the first one is called Being Outed. She fed her drug dealer X-lax and lesbian love letters before hiding beneath the floorboards during a raid, which I suppose in some sense makes the Mountain Home police force complicit in teaching my sister sexuality. 2 years passed before my dog unwittingly watched me climax in the family computer room. I didn't see her cleaning beneath her tail, but I heard the licks right at the end, which syncopated my finish. And I was ashamed when my sister checked the history and found not only gay, but public gay sex. In hindsight, I'm praying she doesn't know about the dog. Maybe she's into watching. I'd rather everyone ask first for permission. I was raised pretty predominantly in the South, and one of the really cool things that I heard from some Southerners, not all, but some Southerners, was this wild association of queerness with pedophilia and of queerness with bestiality. And so if I'm writing a teenage queer masturbation poem, I'm going to put an animal in it. second one is called Uncommon Deer. Kyle, Garrett's teenage brother, unlike neighboring hilltop cedars, hurled between tree fort planks the blue moon bottles. As puberty and the white-tailed voyeur, interrupting midnight whimpers, feel the rhythmic heart against your chest, sneak glances between Playboy pages. Center your chest on the spray paint X, closing its red eyes around the beehive. Remember this as your childhood until the razor burns, when the leaves spatter, shedding blink by blink wrapped, not like an old woman whose hair falls out in fistfuls on her pillow. Reaching over the bank of prickly pear, erect from soil to velvet sky, the live oak sucks the soil. Garrett writhing on the hammock, lungs fill, full faces bursting red, until the doe stops mid-stride, and a small halo of rubberized rope locks eyes with yours rolling. I think we're moving away from masturbation now. No promises. This one's called Could Be Anyone, after Richard Sykin. Could be anyone. A man walks out of, you know this story, get it started. A man walks anywhere and this keychain clangs, it doesn't matter, on the curbside, jangles off the dash. At least there is a man and keys. A ruby red car then, silverfish likely, in your pantry or spotless shelves, keys, a man walks, and in your own grip, your dick. Microwave popcorn, unmade bed, and the lights on. You leave the door unlocked, your eyes closed to spite you, and when you dream, it's horses' manes and old cats, because you're practicing autonomy, going to sleep alone without calling. Funny, you say with toothpaste, I slept like a rock. Stovetop masala for lunch, paper napkins, time to spare, you rest your head in your own lap, stretch the strong neck muscles, and grin against the open window's light. A man walked out of whatever last night, and that doesn't concern you. Lotion on the back of each leg, thick around the arms, ear, nose, throat, appointment at 2, and the two of you scheduled for a productive afternoon together at the cafe or at his place, wherever, it doesn't make a difference. Your man walked into a car and brushed it off. Collected his keys from the puddle and piled himself into his own car, twisted his ignition, saw best when covering one eye and tickled the curb with his tire enough to get a lap off the rubber to send him howling. Whistles from the living room fan sounded off with coffee the same morning as any morning, the slow drip steady, the overhead AC hissing through tightened slats all afternoon until, you know how it is, you get the punchline, the knee slap. A man walked out of a bar while you were still sleeping like a rock, you had said to yourself, his pillow and cologne lingering with the chime of the doorbell. You told him this joke before, but he thought listening like sleep was better for the dead. I was asked to write a poem, an ekphrastic poem, responding to the art of Anonymous Bosch for this anthology, and I didn't write an ekphrastic or send it to the anthology. But I did get into the head of Bosch. So here he is. An impotent Hieronymus Bosch to the horsehair paintbrush. In 54 years and 16 months or so, you'll still stick your staggered teeth one over the other out at passers-by while I grow nose hairs underground, which is to say you're stacked and lasting. Horsehair brush, simply fabulous. Each of your colonnaded folds delights the microscopic eye, you pillar of thatched fabrics extracted from the stallion's back, you swaying reed host of the cricket's chirp and horsehair worm. It pleases me to douse your face, its clementine, marshmallow, dirty goad to resuscitate them again, gummed and liquid. The sun will rise soon. Rotten cock will bray on its stoop. Synecdochal savior, you punctuate or drag across the panel or the canvas as I seem to choose. You die and revive yourselves. Here the strand, behind a strand, above a strand, beyond a strand, nuzzled compact by the hammered tin clinch. There the strand, owl perch, deer horn you've made, briar, berry rod, catapult and stilt, strand that sinks into the weight of the paint and looses itself as a multifold on the canvas, knuckles on your door, knuckles on my door, another day, deep hair of herd, hair among hairs, explain to me sometime this effortlessness, how you'd open a door, given hands with welcome and no second thought, how you'd keep hard and wet, inserted into any situation and assert yourselves, saying I, and me, and we again, with no self-consciousness. Brush, you've lost me, so I'm returning you to earth. The board you make, the bile, thorn, pinky, finger encircling a navel, hung blossom, wing, splintering a hole. Tell me how you made all of this and the making look a little less like me. Just two more. Can I go back to the past? I don't know if I said it, but if I did, it bears repeating. I am so deeply grateful to have read with you tonight. I got rid of half of the poems a week ago because as I was reading them, they lacked urgency. Not one of them felt like a threat. And I'm beginning to think that if I don't feel threatened, or the poem doesn't feel threatened by what it's doing, that's more decoration than art. And I'm so grateful for the lesson that you live, which I think is pretty similar. Teens in the 2000s. We who shaped our initials with cocaine on the backs of public toilets, unzipped each other's Levi's with teeth off a midday country highway, forced ourselves and each other into cold showers, were found in those cold showers, drowned on our own liquids, knew our destinations by telephone, wire sneakers, knew our nights by individually packaged, variegating mesh according to our needs, furiously prayed in getaway cars parked outside the Omni, slept in cum-stained hospital linens, knew addiction was unlike any one of us, but was a lot like each of these things. Contractual agreement. Neither a cobwebbed foxhole nor a severed kneecap with no owner means anybody is dead. This is something we've agreed upon. Stairs that creak in their centers have no ill will. Whistling trees do not think of me. Stalking shadows don't consider. This is fear. Belief is a pair of plastic scissors designed to avoid drawing blood. They don't come safety guaranteed, and they're not tested for efficiency. This is representation. This is something we have agreed upon, and you are asking me to trust you. You say trustworthy and talk in circles in the high Seattle streets. Outside an elementary, it's dark, and your circles are drawn from previous experiences. Trust means believing the person wants what's best for you, you say. Expecting the message is a ring, a rose gold, flashy, apprehensible. But I don't know decorous, haven't been taught. Of course I want to hear the contract of putting you around my finger emerges from the foxhole and spins another web. But I also need the guarantee that the paper will not cut me. I intend to survive. So kind as to bust your dishes and glasses over here by the kitchen. We appreciate it.
And please join us next week for Yolanda J. Franklin.
Thank you.